This is Tall Tale TV, your podcast for sci-fi and fantasy short stories. This story has multiple parts. To listen to the entire story in one place, visit talltaletv.com/series.
Of Portals and Portents by Leslie Herron. Chapter 13, Gizmondine.
Please, if you have been displaced from your home, write your name along with what room number you've been housed in on the western wall.
Chester lifted the clipboard, directing the attention of the countless bodies swarming around him to the right. He scanned over each head, taking in the pleading looks in their eyes.
If you are missing a loved one, please add their name to the eastern wall.
He moved his hand towards the opposite side of the room.
If you cannot read or write, a member of the Illuminated Path will assist you.
The last 24 hours had been spent scrabbling to reassemble some form of normalcy for his people, but it was a fruitless effort. The missing were tallying too high, the damage of many of the homes too much to fix, and there wasn't enough medical care for those injured in the fall. Using his free hand, Chester rubbed at his tired eyes. Sleep was a commodity he could ill afford. He was climbing down from his wobbly desk with a defeated sigh when he caught sight of Danny entering through the main door, leading a group of a dozen or so figures clad in black. More delegates from the Brotherhood? There was a jerk against his pant leg, and Chester looked down to see a group of small children standing before him. A tightness gripped him as he felt a sad tug in his heart. They reminded him of his days spent huddled in the library, caring for Avis's forgotten orphans. He longed for those simpler times. But a proper orphanage had been erected since his promotion to Prime Minister, and Avis's wayward children were now under Theodosia's care. How kind of her to send him some backup.
I take it you want to help?
They nodded emphatically, and he felt a genuine smile cross his face.
Very well. Some of you may remember Daniel. He is heading up the medical staff over in Building 6C. I have a feeling he would welcome the extra hands.
He waved down one of the white-robed figures and instructed them to escort the children, turning just in time to greet his new guests.
I must say, your learning halls are a sight to behold.
Chester had barely registered the group in its whole before a mousy man, small by nature and impossibly meek, stepped forward and provided him with a deep bow. But there was something off about his too wide smile and his stiff bowl haircut.
And what a delight it is to learn that our missionaries were able to impart upon you the word of the scholar, even if it has evolved over the years.
Chester glanced over at his daughter, who rolled her eyes in return.
Thank you. Charles
Brightworth.
Thank you, Charles. I am glad to hear that you think that.
The monk took his hand with fervor, shaking it vigorously for several intense moments before Chester was able to pry it free. He glanced back at Danny again. She looked distracted, fidgety. He understood. She had come to him after Theodore had spoken with her, and she desperately wanted to find him, to bring him back to their side. Guilt crept up his veins as their eyes met. They had argued, but in the end, he had convinced her, and she agreed that her responsibility was to the people of Avis. Maybe when all this was settled, he could set aside some time to help her in her quest to win her brother back. A pointed cough from Charles pulled Chester abruptly from his musings, and he looked up at the remaining Brotherhood clerics in tow. No, not clerics. These men and women were donned in armor and carried weapons. These were soldiers.
Who else do I have the pleasure of meeting today?
Charles bowed deeply, using his hand to gesture behind him.
Forgive my rudeness, Prime Minister. I would like to humbly present to you a gift from the scholar.
He straightened his back, swiveling on his heel.
These are the Templars the Brotherhood has at their disposal. They are here to help you with your recovery efforts, but also to defend your city as well. And this, the jewel of the Brotherhood, Miss Ruby.
The bodies enrobed in black parted as a member of their ranks stepped towards the front. The most absurdly dressed woman he had ever seen walked forward. Her attire was a mixture of armor and a fancy dress that flared out at the ends like a bell. Despite her short height, she was an imposing woman, yet oddly harmless at the same time. Tightly curled blonde ringlets that faded to white bounced on her shoulders, and a large, floppy black bow sat on the top of her head. She almost looked like a child. As she stepped forward, she grabbed handfuls of her skirt and curtsied so sweetly that it surprised him. He had barely recovered from his shock when the woman straightened up, dropping the ends of her dress, and nodded to Charles.
"Miss Ruby would like to extend her most sincere pleasure at meeting you, and hopes that we may help find a solution to your troubles."
Charles could barely contain his admiration. His grin was practically ear to ear as he stared up at her. Unnerved by the first genuine smile Chester had seen from the cleric, he stumbled over his next words.
Hello.
Shaking her head, Danny stepped forward. Her father was never good at these kind of situations.
"We thank you, Charles, Miss Ruby."
She gave a slight bow.
"If you would, instruct your Templars to help secure those still located up on Avis Isle and bring down any injured. Perhaps even a few of them could split off into groups and patrol the damaged zones and search for survivors."
"Of course, of course."
Charles nodded as he put his hands together.
"We are more than happy to oblige to these terms after we have settled negotiations."
"Negotiations?"
Chester frowned at the implications of the word. Charles lowered his hands, his smile fading to one of dour concern.
"Of course, Prime Minister. While we are a charitable group of people, a gift such as this..."
He paused to gesture behind him once more.
"Is one we wish to see reciprocated. But worry not."
He held up a hand.
"We do not ask much, and it would be of mutual benefit. We are, after all, one of the same faith. If you have somewhere we may speak privately?"
Exchanging a look with his daughter, Chester sighed and turned to the group of people still swarming about the great hall. What did he have that he could give a group of pious soldiers? His throat tightened when he saw the wall reserved for the names of the missing was almost full.
"Very well."
Beads of sweat rolled down into his eyes, causing Eric to curse out loud. 2 days spent under the baking sun, manually rowing oars to keep the ship aloft. It was not how he pictured this trip going. His muscles ached, and his hands were blistered, and his back felt like a stack of loose marbles. He shot a contemptuous look over at the mage.
"You know, this would be a lot easier with 2 sets of hands."
"Well, then it's too bad I'm busy steering, isn't it?"
Atlas simply shrugged as he tilted the ship's wheel.
"Besides, your tiny friend was always telling you not to skip arms or something like that."
Eric ground his teeth in response, forcing his tired body to continue rowing. The first night into their journey, they had encountered a storm. One, according to the Arcanist, that had erupted from nowhere. He was convinced that the hack mage had been snoozing during his shift as lookout. It had taken the 4 of them working together in unison to keep the craft in the sky. Through some harrowing trial and error, they managed to succeed. Well, mostly. One of the balloon's cavities had been punctured, and the mechanism that controlled the starboard sails had been damaged. Hence, his new job as manual rower. Each side of the ship was outfitted with gyrating paddle-shaped sails to catch the wind and tack the ship back and forth along the air currents. He let out a growl of frustration, throwing another dark look in the Arcanist's direction.
"I'm just saying, you could easily engage autopilot and give me a short break. I need to sleep at some point." "Nope, no can do. I'm having to constantly correct the course with your shoddy work on those oars, or haven't you noticed?"
Eric overlooked the insult for the truth in the comment. Every time the sails made a full rotation, the ship lurched nauseatingly to one side. But he suspected that wasn't entirely his fault.
"Barry could do your job, and better too. Just get over here and help me."
"I want to fly the ship. I haven't had a turn yet."
"Will you two please stop bickering?"
Elias pinched the bridge of his nose, closing his eyes. He glowered over the rim of his glasses at them, arguing across the deck like children. The only one more useless at the moment was the large bear, splayed out like a rug on the deck, all four legs spread wide and claws dug deep into the wood. What kind of bear was afraid of heights?
"Yeah, Atlas, you heard the king. It's time to switch."
Eric relinquished his tired grip on the oars and jumped to his feet. His spine cracked in protest, but he ignored it and stomped across the deck to shoulder the Arcanist out of the way. He breathed in a victorious breath through his nostrils, and a smile wormed across his face as he felt his body relax for the first time in a while.
"Oh no, you don't! You're not going to saddle me with the manual labor again!"
Atlas lifted a hand, and calling on the primal forces around him, unleashed a burst of air from his palm that shoved the doctor out of the way and sent him rolling across the deck.
"I'm too pretty for that kind of work."
With no one at the oars, the ship began to list towards the opposite side of the river. Elias struggled across the deck, latching onto the pole of the sail Eric had been manning. He struggled to force the ship out of its dangerous slant, but he wasn't strong enough. He looked over his shoulder, shouting,
"A little help here!"
Unfortunately, Atlas and Eric were in the middle of a heated slap fight and throwing insults at one another like toddlers. There was a tickle in the back of his mind, an invitation to use a greater power. Elias shoved it down and settled on keeping the oars locked in place. This would at least slow their descent. That's when he noticed a break in the river's sides as it began to widen, and in the distance, a glassy horizon. Elias sighed in relief to see they had finally, and barely, arrived at the coast.
"Lads, stop arguing. We're here. It's my turn. Stop being so stingy."
Stomping his foot to grab their attention, Elias repeated,
"We're approaching the coast."
Atlas stopped slapping the doctor long enough to look up. He could still see the tops of trees disappearing beneath the ship on either side of them. He looked up at the sky and then out to the ocean.
"We can't be there yet. It's too soon."
"Quick, while he is distracted, let's fly the ship together."
Before Eric could suggest otherwise, Wraith had taken over his body and used his strength to rip the wheel in their direction. There was a thunderous crack of splintering wood, and as the ship lurched hard to starboard, he found himself holding the shattered remnants of the helm.
Uh-oh.
The ship began to spiral, and the inertia of it sent them all sliding across the deck, save for the bear who had smartly anchored himself in place. Eric watched, helpless to do anything more, as the oars clattered about in the spiral and caught one of the balloon tethers, wrenching it free. And then another.
Oh no.
The ship, stuck in a hard starboard spiral, began to lose buoyancy, and they were headed for a crash landing on the beach, the centrifugal force pinning them against the port railing. Elias looked up in time to see Eric shove the broken wheel into Atlas's hands, and he sent a silent whisper to Thiara, praying to make it out of this alive so that he might inflict bodily harm on his shipmates. It must be a Wednesday. Chester sank back into a heavily padded armchair in one of the many offices belonging to the senior mechanists. If he had known, in his days of lurking in a den of thieves filled with children, that the tedium of ruling a city was far more exhausting, he might have remained in the library. He picked up a stack of documents and sat them on top of another, clearing out space on the cluttered table for his arms to rest.
As I'm sure you're aware, my city is on the brink of collapse. If it is money you want in exchange for your aid, I fear you may be disappointed. I can allocate some, but most will be diverted to repairs.
He pulled out a pen and a blank sheet of paper from the drawer.
And if it's military aid you seek, we have been in the process of dismantling most of our...
Nothing like that.
Charles smiled brightly as he held up his hand.
We do not ask for your meager possessions, Prime Minister. No, we merely...
He exchanged a look with the jewel, who motioned for him to continue.
Wish for your help.
His hands, in the process of opening the ink pen, Chester stopped.
My help? With what?
Indulge me for a moment, if you will.
Charles looked around the finely crafted office. There were portraits aplenty, some dusty, some new. Fragile specimens had been pinned up in box frames, and the skull of a small creature was on display beneath a glass cloche.
This place of learning, this university, it reminds me much of our own holy city. The Brotherhood has a motto, a dictum handed down from the scholar himself. Do you know it?
Chester nodded slowly.
Knowledge is power.
Exactly. Knowledge is power. So simple, but it has allowed us to civilize an uncivilized world, multiple worlds even, all in the search of knowledge.
Charles glanced sideways at the man behind the desk.
Have you read our holy scripture, Prime Minister?
Chester shook his head.
I'm afraid I am not that devout. I grew up with the church providing me food in exchange for listening to their sermons, but it wasn't so much their words, but their act of generosity that kept me alive, and I never forgot the kindness that I saw in them. I believe in that good. Anything else beyond that, I only have a cursory knowledge.
Charles nodded.
And what do you know of the scholar?
Danny answered this time. That he was simply a man, like you or me, who sought out knowledge to the point that he questioned the gods themselves, that they told him their secrets and swore him to silence. When he betrayed them and shared with humanity that information, they locked him away forever in a magical tower.
Oh, well done!
Charles clapped his hands together in excitement.
I see someone has been attending church.
Yes,
and while that is true, it is not the whole truth.
He withdrew a leather-bound tome from a satchel at his side and began flipping through it.
The scholar was indeed a man, but by no means just a man.
Charles cracked the spine of the book, opening it to a page that displayed an image of a divine man in humble robes, but a mask of gold to obscure his face.
He was a traveler, scouring the whole of reality for knowledge in a great ark that existed outside of time and space. One day, he stumbled upon a realm that was the home of two deities, one a goddess of the sun and the other a goddess of the night. How peculiar, he thought, for in all his journey across the cosmos, gods were only a superstition, figments to ease the minds of the ignorant masses. But here, in this world, a boundless font of magic gave rise to their implausible existence. One would think that a world graced with magic and gods that lived among mortals would be one of peace, a paradise. But alas, ignorance was universal, and the denizens of this world waged wars over who was the greater god. It did not matter to them that the gods themselves were lovers. Regardless of the strife, the scholar approached these deities and they welcomed him on his holy quest. For 50 days and 50 nights, they spoke of the workings of the world, the universe, and the beyond. And when the scholar had learned all they had to teach him, he couldn't help but ask, "Why do your people fight wars in your name? Why do you allow them to suffer at your feet? Please, let me show you a better way." Enraged by the boldness of the scholar, the two goddesses retaliated with wrath. Who was he to question them? "Traitor!" they shouted as they bound him in chains. "Heathen!" they cried when he merely begged to show them a different path. After spending all that time living among their people and off the fruits of their lands, the goddesses smashed his ark and banished him to the recesses between worlds, locking him away in a tower of endless books. All the knowledge he could read in 1,000 lifetimes, but no way to share it.
Charles closed the book and looked at the faces around the room, enraptured by his story.
"But he escaped and walks among us still, hoping to one day reconstruct his ark and continue his journey."
Chester set down his pen and exchanged a look with his daughter.
"All right, so what do you want?"
Charles dropped his hands.
"The ark, of course."
Pinching the bridge of his nose, Chester let out a long exhale. This was why he had brought back the church without the heavy-handed doctrine. Zealots believed in the literal word rather than the moral of the story behind it.
"I'd be more than happy to finance an archaeological expedition, but at the moment I am in the middle of trying to save a dying city. What more can you expect from us at a time like this?"
"From what little we have seen of your city, we know you have the means to..."
"East!"
At last, the woman spoke, and Chester could see why she had remained silent up to this moment. Her voice sent his flesh crawling with goosebumps. It wasn't human. It sounded closer to those of Atticus's robots, but he could see no device or machinery on her at all. Charles moved to her side, bowing deeply.
"Please, madam, allow me to speak for you. I..."
Ruby whirled, backhanding the sniveling priest with an armored fist.
"Quiet!"
Horror-stricken, Chester watched as the cleric buckled to his knees, blood streaming from between the fingers he clutched to his face. He was even certain he heard a tone of gratitude mingled in with his muttered apology. Ruby turned toward him again, her face screwing up in monumental effort.
"Holy land to the east. Tyrant king blocks the way."
Every word, every syllable caused her excruciating pain. But rather than succumb, she used it to fuel her emotions.
"Help us kill Elias."
"Are you sure it was okay to leave Atlas and Barry on the ship?"
Eric stooped to pluck up another wooden remnant from the edge of the river's bank. There was still a fair amount of distance to cover for them to reach Still Harbor. So, he occupied his mind by sifting through the various debris to repair their own ship. The sun had finally begun its descent, washing everything with a rosy glow and bringing relief to his baked skin.
"He said they would catch up as soon as he gets Barry dislodged from the deck."
Elias shot the doctor a flat look as he pried up a sheet of metal from the mud. He examined it carefully before tossing it back along the water's edge. It wasn't the right alloy.
"Besides, they can't cause any more damage than you already have."
"Oh, come on. Just the wheel itself broke, not the pulley system or anything like that. And the starboard sails just need a new chain in the mechanism. Both of those things are an easy fix, and both technically not my fault.
Atlas is responsible for all of it. The ship had eventually lost enough altitude that it crash-landed on its own. The slow decline had thankfully minimized the damage from the impact, but between the constant spinning and ups and downs caused by the working sails, Eric didn't think he could stomach looking at a roller coaster ever again.
All the more reason to keep the two of you separated. I can't have you squabbling while I'm gone and come back to find something else ripped off.
Well, that was Wraith's fault.
Hey!
And we kind of need Atlas to help us find a tracking mage. The last time we were here, this guy tried to snake oil us out of our money. Eric kicked over another board. Unsurprisingly, the river had overflowed its banks, submerging most of the area in a few inches of water. He plucked up the hunk of wood, flexing it between his fingers, before tossing it back with a muddy splash.
I highly doubt anyone would be dumb enough to attempt conning the king of this nation.
A self-important smile wriggled across Elias's features.
And you really need to get control of your shadow bug. Your body doesn't belong to it, and it should remember that.
He stared down at the sheepish shadow cowering in the wake of its owner's steps.
It?
Eric looked up with a frown.
Wraith isn't an it, and we have a mutual agreement. We're friends. As long as he doesn't get me killed, we're good.
He cursed, stubbing his toe on something. Bending down, he noticed another piece of metal, similar to the one Elias had discarded. But the frown remained on his face as he saw another and another, all of them leading to the fresh wreckage of a ship beached on its side.
That's weird. I thought all this debris had washed down from Avis.
Elias followed the direction the doctor had indicated and responded with only a lift of his brow.
Perhaps a ship caught in last night's storm?
That's not from Ebra. That looks industrial.
Eric jogged the rest of the way to the ship, wading through nearly a foot of water now. He placed his hands on the rusty, barnacle-encrusted hull of what looked like a small cargo ship. It wasn't quite what he would call modern, but it came close. Several hundred feet long, with dozens of steel shipping containers spilling into the river. Many of the metal panels that made up the body and keel of the ship were missing, and he could see through to the inner structure.
Not a bad design. Those mechanists of yours know their stuff.
As they approached the rear of the vessel, Elias grew uneasy. The propeller, or what remained of it, was titanic, taller than he was. Even at a glance, he could tell that the metallurgy involved in this craft was beyond anything he had ever seen before. He looked over his shoulder.
There must be a mistake. Nothing this advanced ever set sail in Avis's waters. At least, not while I was there.
Eric could hear the king talking, but his words were nothing in his ears. He had followed the bow of the ship around, taking in the size of the beast, when he saw the devastation. They weren't walking on the innocent shores of an overflowed river, but instead, the drowned mainland of what used to be forest. Thousands of felled trees littered the ground, rocking helplessly in the gentle motion of the water. Horror crept up the back of his neck as he turned and reached out a hand, tapping the king on his shoulder. Caught up in the mystery of such a large cargo ship, Elias ignored the doctor. But as the tapping grew more insistent, he was forced to acknowledge the man. When he turned, his mouth ready to snap out a response, he saw it. A graveyard of ships lay scattered and broken amid the remains of the forest. And there, in the distance, he could see the great wall of Still Harbor, the once towering fortification now barely broke the surface of the water.
All those people.
The color rushed from Elias's face as he felt the ground sway beneath his feet.
No!
Releasing the breath Eric hadn't realized he had been holding, he pulled away to look at the distance. Rough math estimates began flowing through his mind, and he came to the conclusion that even something as massive and heavy as that floating city wouldn't cause enough water displacement to do this.
and the angle of the broken trees indicated the wave had come from the sea, not the river.
Did...
He turned to the king to see him in a similar state of disbelief. He grabbed the man on his shoulder.
Was Avis near a coast or something?
Elias's hand moved to his mouth, pressing against his lips lest he lose his breakfast. He wasn't as quick with the mental math, but he had come to the same conclusion. The storm that had brought his beloved city into this world had brought far more than he had bargained, and caused the sea level to rise drastically.
What have I done?
Reeling from this revelation, Elias staggered back a step. The weight of his actions had just begun to slump his shoulders when he caught sight of movement. He looked up to see a woman running across the surface of the ocean in their direction, her feet never sinking below the water. She was a young Selkie, with a matted braid of blonde hair that trailed behind her as she ran, and amber-colored eyes.
King Elias, it really is you!
The woman fell to one knee as she reached them, grabbing his hand in hers.
Thank the Yara for your return.
She pushed her forehead against his knuckles, stifling a sob.
Everything is in ruin.
He pulled her to her feet, holding her gently by the shoulders.
Are you all right? What happened here?
She tried to smile in return, but it was a fleeting emotion brought on by his display of kindness. She looked towards the other man, the one wearing a familiar coat of blue with white flowers.
There is no time to explain. You both need to come with me. The queen will want to speak with you.
We thank you for joining us for this chapter of the novel Of Portals and Portents, Book 4 by Leslie Herron, in this ongoing series available here on Tall Tale TV. You can find links in the description to where you can listen to all her books and novellas, with new chapters appearing as they are being written and recorded.
All right, children. I appreciate the help, but this is a hospital, not a playground.
I'm a doctor.
Oh my God, please, no!
Put that down. Scalpels are not toys.
Lookie, I found a hat.
That's not a hat, it's a bedpan. Please tell me it was at least clean.
Little help over here.
We're losing him. Time to amputate.
Oh God, please, no! I don't want to die!
Will someone please take the bone saw away from the children? I should have been a veterinarian.